Thanks, Paul, and hi, everyone. It's nice to be back, actually. You should have, does everybody have one of those handouts that sort of folds in half and has tiny, tiny writing on it? Apologies to people whose eyesight is even worse than mine. Paul has given you a background so that I don't need to. And I guess the background for this sort of topic is growing hostility in our secular society towards what they would see as religious fundamentalism, I guess, whether it's Muslim or Christian, who cares? And I want to help us think about the challenge of presenting the God of the Bible faithfully in a secular environment where all religions tend to get tarred with the same brush, I think. Christians, I feel, get increasingly accused of hypocrisy when we speak out against groups like, you know, ISIS or Boko Haram. They say, well, isn't your religion just as barbaric? You know, is it the Crusades that they single out, or intolerance and violence of ancient Israelites when they wiped out the Canaanites? And the end point is usually, well, often, depending who you talk to, theological. That is, doesn't this just prove that your God, that imaginary creature in the sky that you worship, is this immoral deity, and we've got to get rid of him if we want to have a fair, free, flourishing society? And the handouts that I've given you open with a quote from the eminently quotable Richard Dawkins. And I've, as I said, when we covered this at Moore College, I've written it down so I don't have to read it out, because I find it a bit offensive. The secular humanists that I know personally are not given to speaking as hatefully as Richard Dawkins. Otherwise, I guess it's less likely that we'd be friends. But their opinions are increasingly shaped, I think, by this sort of hate speech. And so we've got, I think we have an hour together. I don't want to spend all of that time talking at you. That sounds terrible. Let's see if we can turn this into something a little bit seminary. It's not a great room for this because you're all facing me in seats that point in the same direction. But it would be good to think a little bit about where these sorts of issues intersect with our own particular situations at work or with friends or whatever. So I'm just trying to think how to do this. What I suggest is if you can create groups of, you know, five or six by some people turning uncomfortably around to face the people behind them and make little... do you know what I mean? And now let's practice. Find a group of people that can be your group for the evening and say hi to each other and discuss this question. Is this actually an issue for you with people at work or with friends, or is it more of a just an interest question? So talk about how this question intersects your own lives. Okay, I'll give you 2 minutes. So find a group and talk about my question. You got 2 minutes. All right. I will be inviting you to continue those conversations that you've been starting in your groups. What I'd like you to do now is just have a look at this handout and let me give you a sense of where we're going together this evening. We don't do handouts a lot in Moore College. Education's all electronic these days. So maybe if I'd been into it more, I would have given you some better layout, because basically the more space on the sheet, the less time we're going to take talking about it. So sorry about that. But in my head, this handout really divides into three basic questions. So the first question is the what question, because in my experience, most attacks against the morality of the Old Testament, well, Christianity for that matter, actually begin by misrepresenting the facts. So what I want to do is start with a what. What does it actually say? Let's get the facts straight. And that's really points 2 and 3 in the handout. My next question is a why question. Okay, we got the facts straight. Well, why did they do what it turns out that they actually did? Okay, what reason, what justification did they give for doing that stuff? And that's probably points four, five, and six, maybe. And then my third section is probably a who question. Who is the God of this story? Right? And I want to think perhaps about how this helps us to reflect on the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. It's one and the same God, isn't it, through the whole Bible. So I hope that's all right. Start with a what, think about the why, finish with the who, and that's a band, isn't it? And hopefully we can wrap up in time for some supper at quarter two. So I think I've chosen a passage from Deuteronomy 7. It's tiny, and we will look at other bits of the Bible. So if there is a Bible in front of you, which I expect there probably is, you might find it easier to use that. So either on your handouts or in a Bible with large print, find Deuteronomy chapter 7. And what I would like to do is just read through this text together and think about it for a bit. So I'll just give people a chance to find that text if you're going to be following it in an actual Bible. And I've even luckily chosen the right version, the NIV. I've been reading the NIV 2011 this year. It's great. It's my new favorite. All right, Deuteronomy 7, verse 1. When the Lord your God brings you into the land you are entering to possess and drives out before you many nations, the Hittites, Girgashites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, seven nations larger and stronger than you, and when the Lord your God has delivered them over to you and you have defeated them, then you must destroy them totally. Make no treaty with them. Show them no mercy. Do not intermarry with them. Do not give your daughters to their sons or take their daughters for your sons, for they will turn your children away from following me to serve other gods, and the Lord's anger will burn against you and will quickly destroy you. This is what you are to do to them. Break down their altars, smash their sacred stones, cut down their Asherah poles, burn their idols in the fire. For you are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you out of all the peoples on the face of the earth to be his people, his treasured possession. I find myself very accustomed to that sort of language. I read it, I teach it to my students at the best college in the world. And yet, it's easy to... sometimes I need to try and read that with secular spectacles on. And then it starts to feel a bit more uncomfortable, I think. You might even ask, with your secular glasses on, how this differs from a description of Islamic State or something like that. You know, destroy them totally, show them no mercy. And yet... let's look a bit more closely at this text, because I think there are things that don't quite fit in with that very stark conclusion. For example, if Moses is actually commanding genocide, why does he tell them not to make a treaty? Why does he tell them not to intermarry? That seems to imply that there are going to be people around to make a treaty with and to get intermarried with. There seem to be inconsistencies in this text. And notice too that when he gets down to detail and says this is what you are to do in verse 5, it's far violent language, but it's violence against objects, isn't it? It's against, what sort of objects are they? They're all, I think, religious objects, aren't they? It seems to be violence against Canaanite religion, rather than Canaanite people. So you can see how it's easy to read texts like this and draw conclusions that can gleefully knock down those pesky Christians and put them in their right place. You know, it's just another religious set of fundamentalists who are deluding themselves. And yet, we need to slow down and read more carefully. So my next heading, which I want to spend quite a bit of time thinking about, what do these rites actually do? And I want to begin with not Deuteronomy, but the book of Joshua, because that's where the bad reputation of the Old Testament mainly comes from. And then I want to step back to some other texts and maybe return to Joshua, and then I'll give you a chance to have a chat. So, I wanted to start with Deuteronomy because Deuteronomy is like the blueprint for Joshua. It's the program that Joshua was following. And we'll keep coming back. It's a crucial text in the Old Testament, Deuteronomy. And yet, I think there's another similarity between Joshua and Deuteronomy. That is that Joshua seems to contradict its own rhetoric of violence. For example, have a look at Joshua chapter 10, verse 40. We're going to be flipping a bit. And if you don't feel like flipping, that's okay. I'll read the verses out. Joshua subdued the whole region, including the hill country, the Negev, the western foothills, and the mountain slopes, together with all their kings. He left no survivors. He totally destroyed all who breathed, just as the Lord, the God of Israel, had commanded. So there are several other verses throughout Joshua. It's a bit of a refrain, almost. He left no survivors. He totally destroyed all who breathed, which sounds pretty genocidal, really, doesn't it? And yet, three chapters later, in chapter 13, we see the narrator just matter-of-factly assuming the continued presence of Canaanite peoples among the Israelites. And he gives them this whole list in chapter 13 of places that still have locals. And when you get to the end of the book, Joshua chapter 23, verse 12, is a verse that I've actually printed on your... Oh, no, I haven't. Let me read it to you. Joshua 23, verse 12. Joshua gives this warning to the people at the end of his life. If you turn away and ally yourselves with the survivors of these nations that remain among you, and if you intermarry with them and associate with them, then you may be sure that the Lord your God will no longer drive out these nations before you. Instead, they will become snares and traps for you until you perish from this good land. So that's interesting, isn't it? When you put that together with that rhetoric of destroying everyone who breathes and leaving nothing living alive. But now he's saying this. And did you notice, by the way, in that verse that the threat is not the Lord your God will no longer destroy these people. See the language he uses? He'll no longer drive out these nations before you. And if you have a look through the Old Testament at books outside of Joshua and how they describe the conquest, you tend to find language of driving out, language of expelling, used much more often the language of killing to describe what happened. Leviticus 18 is one example. There's quite a few, but or let me have a look at Numbers because I can find it. Numbers 33, verse 51. In fact, it's quite a long passage, but speak to the Israelites and say, when you cross the Jordan into Canaan, drive out all the inhabitants of the land before you. And that sort of language of driving out occurs outside of the book of Joshua, where inside the book of Joshua, instead of saying the nice, I wish that Joshua would just say drive out. But he says, kill everyone and don't leave everything that breathes even alive. And when you read Judges and Samuel and Kings, the book after Joshua, they're quite open about the fact that actually there were a lot of Canaanites who were neither killed nor driven out. Judges chapter 2 is a very interesting example. But look at verse, or listen to verse 23 in Judges 2. The Lord had allowed those nations to remain. He did not drive them out at once by giving them into the hands of Joshua. Now, what do we make of these tensions, perhaps even contradictions, within the text? And I find it helpful to step back from Joshua. A lot of people are troubled by the way that Joshua and Judges give such different depictions of what happened in the land. I think it's better to see that these are slightly different types of literature. Right? There is some sort of rhetoric going on in the book of Joshua, I think, that is peculiar to the conquest account. This is a rhetoric or a way of speaking that we find in Joshua and a little bit in Deuteronomy, but basically in Joshua, and we don't find it in the other books. And actually, it's interesting, even in Deuteronomy 9, that first text that we read, if you go back to it, it actually says, interestingly, if I can find it, where is it? Here it is. After, he says, when he brings you into the land, and when he's delivered them over to you and you've defeated them, for the beginning, when he brings you into the land you're entering to possess and drives out before you many nations. So the first language in Deuteronomy, because this is not Joshua, it's got a slightly different rhetoric, is the language of driving out. When you've driven out, when you've defeated them, then destroy them, don't intermarry, show them no mercy. And so it's almost what's going on in Deuteronomy 9 seems to be that it's the people who refuse to run. Right? The people who would not be driven out, the people who stayed to fight to the death. If I'd been giving you this talk, 200 years ago, when we were all a lot younger, that would probably be about the end and we could all go home. But a lot of history's happened since then. In fact, no, a lot of history has been discovered since then. A huge body of texts and inscriptions have been dug up by enthusiastic people with pith helmets. And we can actually now compare Joshua with war accounts written by some of Israel's neighbors. And we actually see the same rhetoric being used by Israel's neighbors. So there's a famous inscription from the Moabite king Misha, who had a little victory over Israel, didn't actually last that long. I think a generation or two later, Israel got the upper hand. You know, they're going to and fro. But anyway, this little victory, he says, Israel has utterly perished for always. I have a list of a book over there with a whole list of little inscriptions from the surrounding nations with this, what do we call it in English classes? Hyperbole, right? That rhetoric of exaggeration. Specifically, you see language of all, of young, of men and women, like the all that breathed. You know, they're specific in this rhetoric, just to describe emphatic victories. And scholars have now actually, I think, realized that that sort of exaggerated speech is part of the ancient, what they call a conquest genre, right? Or a standard way of writing about conquest. And I feel, you know, as a historian, you might feel a bit uncomfortable about that. You know, you shouldn't exaggerate, you should tell the truth. What are you doing this for? And yet, conventions of writing history were really different back then. You know, it was a long time ago. And I think, I've been trying to think of analogies, I think the best equivalent today is probably the sporting commentators. You know, the All Blacks annihilated the opposition today. They literally blew them away. With that use of the word literally that only sporting commentators can do. And three, there's a lovely little verse. I don't know if it's lovely or not, but 2 Samuel chapter 11, verse 1. You don't need to look it up. In the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men. It's like, you know, it's wartime. War was like a sport. And exaggerated descriptions were part of the game. You know, they weren't intended or understood. Literally, they were a way of like verbalizing the emotional rush of a victory. I think that's what sporting commentator language is, isn't it? There's, let me give you just one more verse, and then I'll just pause and let you have a little chat. 1 Chronicles 4, verse 41. This is not a conquest narrative, and so it doesn't have quite the same rhetoric, but an interesting parallel. If I got the right... Yeah. The men whose names were listed in the days of Hezekiah, king of Judah, they attacked the Hamites in their dwellings and also the Munites who were there and completely destroyed them, as is evident to this day. Then they settled in their place because there was a pasture for their flocks. And 500 of these Simeonites, led by Pelatiah, Neriah, Raphiah, and Uziel, the sons of Ishi, invaded the hill country of Seir. They killed the remaining Amalekites who had escaped, and they've lived there to this day. And actually, that second word is language of complete destruction. So they completely destroy these people, and then they go out and completely destroy them all over again. You see what I'm saying? This language of complete destruction is, I don't know, it's the language of victory. All right, what am I trying to do here? I'm trying to get an accurate picture of what Israel actually did. And I'm trying to penetrate behind some of the genres of history writing, which are foreign to us, but were very common in the ancient world. It doesn't make all the problems or difficulties go away. But I just want to start by saying, let's not misrepresent the truth as the very first thing we do, because that so often happens. I think I might pause for a minute and get you to regroup your... Yeah, absolutely. And I think I want to go on. What I said at the end was, this doesn't make all the problems go away. Right? It doesn't make us feel, oh, this is all right then. Yeah, but I just want to get an accurate picture of what actually happened, because it seems to me a good starting place to think about the issue is to get the facts right. And to come back to the question of genre and language, you're quite right. Destroy means destroy. And I'm not saying that when they said destroy them utterly, they were using a word that can mean, you know, spank or something. They use a word that means annihilate, to wipe out. But the question is whether the genre question isn't whether the word means something, it's whether different, it's whether the sentiment means something different. You know, so hence my analogy of the sporting commentator saying they annihilated them, right? We say they annihilated, the All Blacks annihilated us, and we don't take it literally because we know it's not meant literally. It's part of the genre of and the Bible is full of texts which aren't trying to deceive us. They're just accounts from a particular genre. We read poetry like poetry. When Jesus says, I am the door, we know he's not being literal. And so the question is, what does it look like to read texts well? And I think one of the aspects of reading texts well is to understand what they're trying to communicate by the way they use language. And I think that's the genre question. There are some times when genre actually is a genuine bone of contention among Christians. How many days did God take to create the world? And that's a genre question. There are arguments all around that, but most of them in the end, I think, come back to genre. And in that case, some Christians say, oh, you're weaseling out of the obvious 7-24-hour periods by getting away from the truth by doing something tricky with genre. I disagree with that, but I think it's a much clearer case here, and I think that looking at the accounts given in some of those surrounding nations make it seem... I'll give you a few more, actually, because I found the book while you were talking. So here's one from the 15th century in Egypt. The numerous army of Mitanni was overthrown within the hour, annihilated totally like those non-existent. And in fact, we know from other sources that the Mitanni were fighting Egypt constantly for the next 200 years. The Hittite king from the 14th century said he made Mount Ashapaya empty of humanity. Ramesses II in the time of Moses says how he slew the entire force of the Hittites. Millions of foreigners were made chaff. And on it goes. And I don't think... I don't understand that all these guys are lying and try to deceive people, and so, you know, why is the Bible lying as well? I think what they're doing is they're just speaking like the sporting commentators, because that's how everybody communicated a decisive victory. And it's weird. It feels, I feel that I wouldn't be able to do that. But they lived in a very different culture. I think that's all I'm saying. But let's use this as a segue to move forward. It doesn't mean they didn't kill people. Right? And I think that gets closer to your question, doesn't it? So let's move on. I'm not trying to say that when we clarify what Israel actually did, we find out that they didn't kill anyone, because they did. And so really my task, I think, now is to listen to the why question, right? The explanation of their actions. And I want to say a few points under, what have I got on my handout? Just one verse from Deuteronomy. We'll come to that in a second. A few points. First of all, let me say the Bible is consistently clear that the Canaanites were not innocent victims. Right? They were guilty of atrocities and crimes that were far in excess of what Israel did in expelling them. And God uses Israel as an instrument of judgment. And not only that, he gives the Canaanites many, many years in which to stop their abuses. There's a really interesting little passage in Genesis 15. I'll just find it because I think it's worth... it's quite an important passage. God makes a covenant with Abraham. And he says in verse 13, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own." He's talking about going to Egypt, right? "They will be enslaved and mistreated 400 years, but I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions. You, however, will go to your fathers in peace and be buried at a good old age. In the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure." It's an interesting reason, isn't it, that God gives for waiting 400 years before Abraham's descendants are going to come back into the land of the land. He says, "I'm going to wait until the behavior of the locals justifies what I'm asking you to do, effectively. We'll come back to that. I think that's a really significant factor in the Bible's reasoning behind Israel's war of conquest, right? That it was, in some sense, in a modern sense, a just war, right? They were punishing crimes against humanity. I want to come back a little bit later and examine what that actually looks like what were the Canaanites really doing. But let's move on. Right? First thing, Canaanite atrocities. Second thing, a strong warning to Israel not to feel morally superior when they do this. To be conscious that they have just as much of a capacity as the Amorites to commit atrocities. And those are the verses that I've printed out on your handouts from Deuteronomy 9. I think it actually sets Israel on a higher moral level than our own society, I think, because we display as Australians an offensive degree of self-righteousness, do we not, when it comes to our place in the world. Deuteronomy 9, "After the Lord your God has driven them out before you, do not say to yourself, 'The Lord has brought me here to take possession of this land because of my righteousness.' No, it is on account of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is going to drive them out before you. Understand then that it is not because of your righteousness that the Lord your God is giving you this good land to possess, for you are a stiff-necked people." And that wasn't a good thing. It's a long way from the rhetoric of the Western nations of the world today, isn't it? Sadly, it's interesting. There are various other reasons, but I think the main reason, really, is two main reasons. First of all, Canaanite atrocities. Secondly, God's plan from the beginning, from the moment that the nations spread out after the flood in Genesis 10, each to their part of the world, and the moment he made a promise to Abraham to give him a land, the point of that was that there would be a space cleared in the world where there could be a people faithful to God who would then be, what does he say, a holy priesthood, a kingdom of priests, a holy nation, show the rest of the world the way of salvation. Right? So we know that God's promise to Abraham to give him a land was a promise whose ultimate aim was that all peoples will be blessed through you. Right? A universal blessing. And the danger of moving in next door to the Canaanites is very clear. Have a look at Deuteronomy 20, for example. Deuteronomy 20, verse 16, which says, "In the cities of the nations the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, do not leave alive anything that breathes." Right, that rhetoric again. "Completely destroy them, the Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded you. Otherwise, they will teach you to follow all the detestable things they do in worshipping their gods, and you will sin against the Lord your God." So the concern is that Israel is prone to sin and rebellion just as much as the nations around. And the moment that it moves in as a minority group, it will assimilate straight away and lose its distinctiveness, and the knowledge of God will disappear from the world. For whose sake is Israel being called to maintain religious faithfulness? Well, among other people, for the sake of the Amalekites and the Canaanites, that they too, if they have been driven out and remain alive to hear the news, may be like Rahab and join in with the people. It's really interesting, I think, that if you go a little bit back in Deuteronomy 20 to verse 15, I think it is, verse 10, you get another apparent contradiction. He says, "When you march up to attack a city, make its people an offer of peace. If they accept and open their gates, all the people in it shall be subject to forced labor and shall work for you. If they refuse to make peace, they engage you in battle, lay siege to that city. When the Lord your God delivers it into your hand, put to the sword all the men. As for the women, the children, the livestock, take these as plunder. You may use the plunder the Lord gives you from your enemies. This is how you are to treat all the cities that are at a distance from you and do not belong to the nations nearby." It's a bit weird in so many different levels. But the thing I want to draw out of that is the fact that here is a situation. Deuteronomy is very situational. He says, what do you do in this situation? What do you do in that situation? Here's a situation where Israel has been at war with a city that is not in the local area. And it says, in that case, if you marry a woman from that city, that's okay. Think of Naomi and Ruth from the land of Moab, coming in and marrying. And the reason seems to be that there's no danger if you just have one or two people. When once Israel is settled in the land and has, you know, the law of God, the covenant ruling the whole nation, then for outsiders to come in and join that covenant is great. And so that's why there's a different rule for the cities far away. Assimilation, that's all right, because they're assimilating and learning the true knowledge of God. However, if you come in as a little minority and assimilate with the majority Canaanites around you, that'll be a disaster. So let me just summarize and then move on. The basic justifications really are that this is a just thing. These Canaanites are guilty of atrocities. And God is using you as a tool for their judgment. But don't think that you're special. You are just as liable to sin as they are. And that's why you need a space that is free of influences that will take you away from God. Does that make sense? Is that clear? Next question. I think I've made it a little point in your outline. Have we any evidence that this demonizing of the Canaanites is not just Israelite propaganda? You can see I'm a good postmodern cynic, can't you? Read this sort of question all the time. And I think it is helpful just to try and get some sort of a fix on what it is these Canaanites were up to anyway. And it is clear in numerous texts and images as well that we've dug up from Israel's contemporaries. They were into, you know, torture and bloodbaths and massacres in graphic, gleeful detail. And the thing is, the really interesting thing about reading some of those texts is that they justify all this butchery from their religion. And I've given you quite a long description in your handouts of what it took to satisfy the Canaanite goddess Aneth. And I'll read you, leave you to read it later just because of time. But basically, in summary, it's a description of a goddess who decorates herself with the severed heads and hands of townspeople and old men while she wades knee-deep in their blood. And that's pretty good, but she's still not satisfied until she can lure their soldiers and their heroes to hospitably arranged tables and then slaughter them unaware. Those were the gods that the Canaanites venerated. And the Canaanite culture is shaped by that religion. Leviticus 18, we won't look at it, but it describes Canaanite practices. Incest, bestiality, ritual prostitution. Deuteronomy 12 and many places in the Old Testament describe child sacrifice. You shall not cause your infants to be burned in the fire like the people around you. Translate that into a modern society, into our modern world, which Western superpower would not go to war against a nation that was sacrificing its children? Those were the gods and the religion of the Canaanites that God gave them for four generations to do something about. All right. Let me just pause again, because I've dealt with the what and the why, and I want to think about the who. I've got another heading about, did Israel's behavior standard is any different? Let me just say one more little thing about Israel's behavior. The Old Testament's a little bit tricky on this heading, because there are a lot of laws given, which are excellent laws, and when you read the history in the books of Samuel and Kings, you get a picture of a society that didn't often keep those laws. I think of the law of the Jubilee. You remember the Jubilee? Like, after 50 years, you blow the trumpet and give the land, the slaves back and the land back. I don't think that law was ever kept, ever, in Israel's history, as far as I can make out. However, we do know from descriptions that they did not live like the Canaanites. When you look at Joshua and descriptions of what they actually did in detail, they seem to be selectively targeting the political and military leaders and the enemy soldiers. It seems that women and children and non-combatants were off limits. There's interesting legislation in Exodus and Deuteronomy that specifies not punishing children for the sins of their parents or pregnant women, etc. And even cities like Jericho and Ai, which we know famously from Sunday school, were totally destroyed and everyone in it. When we look at the archaeological records, it appears that they were, at the time of Joshua, military strongholds virtually empty of all civilians. They were military outposts. And Joshua 10, I won't read it now, but Joshua 10, 25 to 27 is really interesting. It describes the execution of five captured leaders. It's sort of symbolic, the five kings of the Amorites. It's done with amazing restraint. Joshua 10, that was verse 25. And basically, by comparison with the horrific torture that the Assyrians would regularly do on captured prisoners of war, this is humane. This is dignified, but it's just, and it's extreme for a nation without the death penalty. It's difficult, but compared with the surrounding nations, it's restrained. And Canaanites who respect Israel's God, people like Rahab and her family, sure, live freely among us. That's the practice that's recorded. And just one final contrast that I think is worth pointing out between Israel and the surrounding nations, and that is You know, I've talked about there's a rhetoric of war, which we find pretty much only in Joshua, although also in 1 Samuel 15. This war of conquest was a one-off event, according to God. They weren't to do this again. Deuteronomy chapter 2, I will take this verse as my final one, I think, because I think it's a significant verse. Verse 4 of chapter 2, give the people these orders. You are about to pass through the territory of your brothers, the descendants of Esau, who live in Seir. They will be afraid of you, but be very careful. Do not provoke them to war, for I will not give you any of their land, not even enough to put your foot on. I've given Esau the hill country of Seir as his own. You are to pay them in silver for the food you eat and the water you drink. And he says exactly the same of the Moabites a bit further in this chapter. There's a really strong sense in the Old Testament that God has given each nation a plot of land. And this was the nation, your plot of land, Abraham. Right? I promised it to you from the very beginning. In the table of nations after the flood, everybody has their plot, and this was yours. It's legally been yours from the beginning. Sure, there were other people squatting on your land, right? But I'm not even going to let you drive them out of the land that is legally yours until they've completely committed all these war crimes. And once you've got the land, no more. That's yours. Don't conquer the Edomites. Don't make an empire for yourselves. And after Joshua, the only war that was permitted by God was defensive war. Sure, Israel went on offensive wars from time to time, but always without God's permission. They had no standing army. When David takes a census at the end of 2 Samuel, ostensibly, I think, for the purpose of raising an army, there's a big judgment. We don't have standing armies in this country. And if you do fight, you don't get paid. And if you don't want to fight, you don't have to. Deuteronomy 20. And if you're a king, you don't actually have authority to declare war. You've got to get permission from God through a prophet. Now, maybe that description sounds a little bit normal to you, but in the ancient world, that was absolutely unique. Right? Just as Canaanite social values were closely connected to their idea of the gods, Israel's unique behavior is a reflection of a unique God. So I'm going to just pause and give you a brief moment to chat again, and then we'll try and draw it together. I've gone a little bit longer than I wanted, but just take a few minutes to talk about issues that are still problematic, or issues that you didn't quite get, or things that you think, oh yeah, that's good, I'm glad I heard that. Just take a few minutes to chat amongst yourselves, and then we'll come back together. I'll give you less than a minute because I hear the volume dropping. And also, we need to press on. Rick's given me permission to go a little bit past 1:45, so I think I will do that, and you can blame him. I don't think I'll get any feedback now just for time, but I will just take up the Amalekite question very briefly in 1 Samuel 15. Somebody asked it up the back. Because it just allows me to raise one little technical question. There's a language of devoting to destruction that you see in the book of Joshua especially. It was devoted to destruction. You know, Achan gets judged after Ai is destroyed because he took some of the things that were devoted to destruction. And that's language that's associated with this idea of God's war in the Old Testament. It means when you go and conquer the land, this is not personal. This is not you conquering for gain. You are God's tool. And you are allowed to benefit from this conquest as much as a sword is allowed to benefit from the person that it's killed. It's God's war. And so you don't enrich yourselves. You know, that would muddy the ethical waters. Everything is given over to God, and in the case of people, that involves killing, punishing. And that language of devoting to destruction is used in Joshua, and then about 10 more times in the story of the Amalekites in 1 Samuel 15. And so they seem to be a little extension to the war of Joshua. What is special about the Amalekites that they get treated like the people in the book of Joshua in the time of King Saul? And I think the answer is that the Amalekites, if you look at the history of the Amalekites in the Old Testament, and I'm not going to go through it, you'll be happy to know, it starts, I think, the very day after they cross the Red Sea when they're all weary and worn out and the Amalekites come and attack them. And the Amalekites are still there at the very end of the Old Testament in the book of Esther, where Haman is an Amalekite who's trying to destroy the Jewish people. And it seems that the Amalekites are the one group of outsiders who are the most tenacious enemies of Israel and completely impossible to assimilate into the worship of the one true God. And so I do think that the Amalekites get a little special treatment in the book of 1 Samuel. But that was such an excellent question that I couldn't resist from saying something about it. All right. Let me just finally, and hopefully a bit more concisely, consider the who question. Because if you remember at the end of the last little slot, I said that the reason the Canaanite society and Israelite society feel so different is that their gods are so different. Because, you know, we are what we worship, they say, don't they? And so I just want to think about what sort of God Israel actually served. And I want to do it by thinking about the book of Exodus, from which I've given you a few, well, one quote anyway. You know, the God of the Old Testament could not be more different from the fictional character that Richard Dawkins invented. He's the same God on every page. And the foundational document for Israel's doctrine of God, their understanding of who God is the book of Exodus. Remember Exodus? It is a story about a group of slaves rescued by a God they do not know. And he takes them on a journey to a mountain where they will meet him face to face and be changed for good. And everything that happens to Israel is designed to show them more about what God is like, what his journey, what his name means. And so I think Exodus is a great book. It's a book that has an external journey and an internal journey. Like a good Disney movie, you know, you have the plot and then you have the hero's journey, don't you? The journey, or a travel book. You know, I went through Africa with my backpack, and you know what it was? It was a journey of discovery. Exodus is a journey of discovery. And what they're discovering is, who is this God that has brought us out of Egypt? By the time they cross the Red Sea, what have they learned? That God's name means Savior, that his name means warrior. And when they come out and sing the song of the sea after the crossing of the Red Sea, they say, "The Lord is my strength and my song. He's become my salvation. The Lord is a warrior. The Lord is his name." And that's the Lord Yahweh. Remember at the beginning of Exodus, Moses says, "Who shall I tell them? Sent me." And God says, "Say, I am who I am. Yahweh." It sounds in Hebrew like "I am sent you." And so what they're learning is, what does Yahweh mean? And the Red Sea crossing shows them it means warrior, it means savior. And when they get to the mountain, they learn that God, unlike every other god they've ever worshipped, is not part of his creation. He's the creator of everything. He's outside and above the universe, and he is jealous for his name. Because when people name the creation as God, they're cutting themselves off from their source of life. It's the logic of the second commandment. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. For I, Yahweh your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. So don't make an idol. I am not my creation. If you hate me, this happens. If you love me, that happens. So far, so good. Right? They've reached the mountain. They're discovering what God's name means. But then what happens in Exodus? You remember the tragedy of the golden calf, right? And we get this new, unexpected question about God. Can there be room in his nature for mercy? For mercy. And the climax of the book comes in chapter 34. When God speaks his name once more, and in the aftermath of Israel's sin and judgment, he takes us all the way into his nature. Verse, I've given you an excerpt, 33:18, and then on to 34:5. Moses said, "Now show me your glory." Then the Lord came down in the cloud and stood there with him and proclaimed his name, the Lord. And he passed in front of Moses, proclaiming, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children and their children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation. Now, there are two, that sounds very much like the commandment against idolatry, doesn't it? I, the Lord, am a jealous God. But there are two changes. First of all, he reverses his self-description. He mentions his mercy first. And he no longer says, showing love to a thousand generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. Because what did Israel do with a golden calf? They didn't love God and they didn't keep his commandments. But now, God puts mercy at the first and he says, maintaining love to thousands, forgiving wickedness, rebellion and sin. No qualification of who receives this grace. And so with God, and yet there is judgment. Because there's no mercy without judgment. There's no judgment without mercy. And yet, mercy comes first. God called Abraham in mercy. And mercy comes last. After they rebelled against God, he yet showed mercy. Now, I'm going to skip the other verses in your handout because it's time to almost time to wrap up, I think. Why am I talking about who God is? Partly because I find it more exciting and edifying than talking about killing people. But my point in talking about the character of God is I really think it's only when we understand Israel's unique God that we can really understand what is going on in Joshua's war of conquest. Right? Joshua is being commanded to, I think I used this language before, clear a space in the world filled with idols so that God's true nature can be displayed to the world, God's name. And this is crucial. The whole point of the exercise is not to bring good to Israel, but to the whole world, just as God promised Abraham. And nothing shows, I think, the universal purpose of the conquest more remarkably than what happened next in the history of Israel. Right? What happened when Israel started behaving like the Amalekites? When they turned away from God and worshipped idols, what did he do? Like the Amorites, he mercifully warned them, didn't he? He sent the prophets again and again. They ignored the prophets. What happened next? Do you remember? He took another nation, Babylon, and he used them as his tool to expel Israel from the land into exile. God is no respecter of persons. And his wrath against human evil is not in spite of his love, it's because of it. Well, just want to make one more comment and then we'll finish up. If you're interested in going further, I've got a couple of books by a guy called Paul Copen. Is God a Moral Monster? Making Sense of the Old Testament God. And then one called Did God Really Command Genocide, which is he's written with somebody else. It's more recent, longer, and I'm not sure if it's better, actually. It's different. Go and have a look at those if you like. I'll leave them up. But I want to just reflect a little bit on where we go with this as Christians. I've been in the Old Testament the whole time, which is great because it's a Christian book. But we've been thinking about how, I think most of this evening has been a how not to read the Bible evening. How do we not apply these Old Testament texts to us today? And I think it's very important because too often bad reading of these texts is used to justify wars. Actually, probably not the Crusades, I think, despite the rhetoric. History suggests that Crusades weren't justified on the basis of Joshua. But plenty of wars by so-called Christians against, of colonization especially, in the Americas, in South Africa. Joshua has been used as a pretext for atrocities. That's an important thing for us to recognize and condemn. But I want to think about the positive. Well, that's how not to read it. How do we read it? I've got a verse, I think, that I want to start with because Joshua means Jesus, doesn't it? It's the same name. And Joshua fought to make space for the kingdom that was actually established finally by Jesus. You know, everything else was a failed attempt, wasn't it? Leading up to Jesus' establishment of the kingdom of God. And Jesus reigned from his throne by being nailed to it. If you want a verse to sum up a proper Christian response to holy war, I'd go for John 18, verse 36. My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would fight. And it's like Joshua fought so that we don't have to. And there's a sort of story the Bible tells, which is a story of war. Let me tell you that story, and then we'll finish up. God clears his world of rebellious humans by judgment, right? Like Genesis 6 and the flood. There's something similar that happens when Joshua is used by God, like a overwhelming flood to sweep away rebellious humanity, and yet, of course, not using a flood, but using a human army. And then he uses that people as building blocks of like a new creation, a new Eden, with God among them in their midst, but with the new protection of the Sinai covenant in place because of their sinfulness. That land was like Eden, it was like the rest of the seventh day, the place where they could enjoy fellowship with God. And that land, the climax is 2 Samuel 7, when it says God gave David rest from all his enemies, and then Nathan makes him the promise about the Messiah. And yet, with rebellion against God, Israel keeps rebelling against God, and God punishes them by sending military opposition. And how do you fight back? Well, you trust in the word of God, whether it's Gideon, whether it's Joshua, whether it's Hezekiah. The force is overwhelmingly strong. You trust in the word of God, and he wins the victory. And yet, of course, Israel, you know, true to their name, wrestles away with God, refuses to accept his plan until they're no better than the Canaanites, and off they go into exile. There's a difference, I think, with exile. God uses the destruction of Babylon, the destruction of their captors, as their instrument to bring them back to the land. Babylon first comes in the Bible, actually, as the Tower of Babel, same name. And it sort of represents organized human resistance to God. And by the end of the Old Testament, Babylon is like a symbol of evil, of death itself. And so the Old Testament's presentation of Israel is like, when you're going to Babylon, it's like you've been swallowed up by death as a nation. You've been condemned to death. And to bring you back, death is going to be destroyed. Babylon is going to be torn apart, and you're going to be pulled out of the carcass of this death monster. I'm thinking of the end of Jeremiah. He's got this amazing poetic language about the fall of Babylon. And all of that history and prophecy is just laying down plans for the coming of Jesus. Right? He was the ideal Israelite. He always trusted God to do the fighting. He trusted God, and then God let him be swallowed up by death anyway. Is that a betrayal of Jesus' perfect trust for God to do that? Well, maybe, except that on the third day, death was destroyed and the Messiah was raised with an incorruptible body to sit at the right hand of God, where he still sits wearing his human body right now. And that path of trust, judgment, death, exaltation, that is a path that Jesus has walked so that we can follow in it, isn't it? And we cling by faith to Christ and let God do the fighting. It's the same as Joshua, but it looks different because we have the real thing. Jesus is the temple. Jesus is God with us. We're being built up into him, stones in the living temple. And we enter into our rest, according to Hebrews, by believing in Jesus, don't we? And in the meantime, we fight, but we don't fight against flesh and blood, Ephesians 6. We fight with faith and hope and love, and we follow the real Joshua Jesus on that path of endurance. That's the way the book of Revelation puts it. So we have the language of warfare, but it's transformed through Christ. All right, I think I need to stop. I feel definitely the need of some supper. What I might do is...